Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. A recent study, and I expect you probably heard about this, it's got a lot of news coverage, suggested that people who don't have high cholesterol can actually benefit from using a cholesterol-lowering drug. It can actually reduce their chances of heart attack and stroke. Now, although these people didn't have high cholesterol, they did have high levels of something called C-reactive protein, which indicates inflammation in the body. And that, says our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Mark Laponis, is something that can be predictive, that is, the C-reactive protein, can be predictive of a lot of other diseases. This morning, we'll be talking a little bit about that and also about his general argument that if you're interested in living a long and healthy life, not just a long life, but also a long and healthy life, you should be thinking about your immune system and keeping it from being overactive, because he also makes the argument that, in fact, aging is a disease of the immune system and it has to do with an overactive immune system. And what you want to do is keep your immune system nice and calm. And he writes all about that in a book that's titled Ultra Longevity, the 7-Step Program for a Younger, Healthier You. It is now available in paperback. It's published by Little Brown. So if you're interested, you can find it in the bookstore. And of course, this morning, as we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just keep their questions brief, just so we can keep moving along. But of course, anyone who is interested in calling in is welcome to do that. The number, 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can certainly give us a call. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about him. He is the medical director of the Canyon Ranch Spa, and they have locations a number of places around the country, including in Massachusetts, where he lives, also in Arizona, Las Vegas, in Florida. He is a classically trained doctor in internal medicine. He's board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine in internal medicine and also formerly in critical care medicine. And he's joining us by telephone. Again, questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Laponis, hello.
Hi, this is David.
Yes. Thanks for talking with us. And maybe just one more thing I would mention, sure. People might find interesting, that you're also a cancer survivor.
That's true.
You had kidney cancer at what seemed to me to be, would be a relatively young age. Were you just 37?
I thought it was pretty young.
Yeah. So I'm glad to have you with us.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the invitation.
Just as a way to start, this was kind of the hook to start off. I'm just interested in your reaction to this study that I mentioned.
I think that'll be great.
Yeah, and then of course I think it led all people to ask questions about, well, you know, does that mean everybody should be taking statins?
Right.
And I think maybe the answer is, well, probably not everybody.
I don't think they should put it in the water yet.
Yeah. Well, so tell me about what was your reaction to this study?
Well, I think it's, you know, another part of the growing evidence in favor of doing more widespread testing with C-reactive protein, which has not become routine but really needs to. It's finally hit prime time for a test that should be a routine test, because we found that that is a more important decision point than someone's cholesterol. But the take-home is not necessarily that everybody should be on a statin, but everybody should be focused on the C-reactive protein level and taking steps to lower it. And what people don't know is it's largely under their control. They're able to lower their own C-reactive protein level without necessarily having to take a statin.
And what does C-reactive protein do?
Well, it's one of the chemical messengers of the immune system. It's sort of a smoke signal or a distress flare that the immune system sends up when it's fighting some type of battle. Mm-hmm. And it could go up from a number of reasons. Somebody that has an infection, or somebody that is under stress or not getting enough sleep. And we should talk about the things that might affect the C-reactive protein level and how to deal with them.
Yeah. And your suggestion is that high levels of C-reactive protein would not only be an indicator that you were at risk of heart disease or stroke, but you would say that high levels of this would be an indicator that you might be at increased risk of developing a number of conditions.
Sure. It's been linked with as a predictor of Alzheimer's, of aneurysms, of cancer, of diabetes, of hypertension, of macular degeneration. So there are many things that the C-reactive protein predicts, none of the things that we, you know, any of us us want.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that is not now routinely checked when people go in for checkups?
Well, the test has been around for maybe 8 years and has not yet become routine, but now there's such a growing amount of evidence around the importance and the value of testing. Part of the problem is doctors, if they tested, didn't always have a solution. But now with Jupiter, of course, they're feeling like they can prescribe something. But we need to get the message out that there are things that people can do themselves so they might not have to go on prescription medications.
Mm-hmm. And just one more question about the test for C-reactive protein. Is that particularly expensive?
It's not. It's really about it's $30 or $40 retail, so it's not an expensive test, and it's now widely available. When it first came out 8 years ago, it was really only a couple labs around the country that were running it, but now it's just about every single lab has access to the test.
Hmm. Well, just let's talk about what is here the central idea of the book, and something that is an important, for you seems to be a very important idea, and that has to do with the immune system. It's particularly an overactive immune system and the relationship there to disease. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, most people think when they come in my office that they want to boost their immune system somehow and get it, you know, fighting better. But that's not necessarily true. If you think of your immune system as the defense or the army of your body, you'd rather have it like working like the reserves, you know, ready, willing, and able to fight, but not actively fighting a battle or a war, because remember, we're the battlefield, so there's some collateral damage and friendly fire that actually causes damage along the way when your immune system is up in arms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the key here is not to have a fighting strong immune system, but have one that's able to respond when needed.
What do you think about things that people do because they think that they need to boost their immune system functioning?
Well, largely they haven't been proven to be a benefit. In fact, at times they can be detrimental. Something that stimulates or overstimulates the immune system could have adverse consequences. But what we've tried to do in the book is to really bring the science to the C-reactive protein test, to the immune system, and really explaining what things are helpful and beneficial. And, of course, you know, there's always a balance. You don't want a suppressed immune system, of course, but you want an immune system that's, again, not fighting.
Mm-hmm. People, maybe you could talk a little bit more about the immune system and how it works. I expect people, have this idea that, it's there, it's something that my body has, and it's the defense mechanism, and when you get sick or you get germs, this is the thing that goes into action and is supposed to fight those things off. So either you don't get sick or you get well quicker than you would otherwise.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And until about 80 years ago, we all needed a very strong immune system. But 80 years ago, they invented something called penicillin. And since then, of course, we've got, you know, dozens of vaccines. We have, you know, surgical intervention if somebody has appendicitis or diverticulitis. So there's a lot more ways to combat infections. And now people are not dying so much from infections. They're dying from the complications of an overactive immune system, and that is heart attack, cancer, stroke, hypertension, diabetes, all diseases linked with too active an immune system.
We had a question here from someone who was asking their question off the air, so I'll ask it in their benefit. Someone is interested in having you talk about the difference between C-reactive protein and sensitive C-reactive protein, or a test. Are those two different things? Or are we talking about two different tests?
Yeah, it's the same. They're measuring the same thing. Mm-hmm. But one method is more accurate, more sensitive. It can measure lower levels of C-reactive protein. So you do definitely want the sensitive C-reactive protein level, because that will tell you if you're 0.3 or 1.3, whereas the generic sort of C-reactive protein test will not give you that kind of specificity. And in Jupiter, they really needed to know who was above 2 and who was less than 2. That was the cutoff for prescribing. So it's important to get the high sensitivity form of the test.
Okay. Well, other questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Mark Laponis, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And just again, he is the medical director of Canyon Ranch. He makes his home in Lenox, Massachusetts, where Canyon Ranch has one of their spas. He is a physician, classically trained in internal medicine. He also does a lot of talking, speaking, and writing on television and radio. He is the author of a book that is now out in paperback. The title is Ultra Longevity, the 7-Step Program for a Younger, Healthier healthier you. And as we have discussed, he makes this argument that a lot of illness has to do with having an overactive immune system. And the book gets at what he argues you can do to have a calmer immune system. And I have to say, when I first saw the book, I thought, yeah, right. You know, there seem to be so many people offering plans on how you can live forever and never get sick. And sometimes they ask you to do strange and exotic things. And I guess I would have to say, looking at the things that you suggest, that I'm not sure that anybody could really go wrong following your plan, because it's not particularly exotic. It contains things like, well, have a good diet and get plenty of rest and get some exercise and try to have a positive outlook on life and have close relationships with other people. It's nothing really exotic at all. It certainly doesn't involve taking any magic pills.
No, that's true. And I think what's interesting for people is when you say have a healthy diet, people don't really know what that means for the most part. And they think, you know, of course they know about fruits and vegetables, but there are a few things that are really important in terms of the diet. And we talk about some of those in the book, ultra longevity. But I think people really need to get a better sense for why they're eating the way that we're asking them to eat and what it's actually doing in terms of their health for prevention and the effect that it's having on the blood markers like C-reactive protein.
All right. Well, we have some questions here. Let's get to some more callers, and we'll go to line one to start us out right here. Hello, line one. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm wondering, I understand that you're emphasizing good diet. I'm wondering if there's ever occasion to take a supplement like zinc during cold and flu season or when you feel the symptoms of a cold coming on, echinacea glycerite.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of things that people can take to help improve the function of their immune system. And in the book, we talk about seven things that people can take or do. And we started off with the things that people can do, because I think it's human nature to just know, you want to know, what can I take? That's the easy thing. What can I take to make me better, as opposed to what can I do? So we start off with six things that you can actually do to improve your immune system, and then one chapter on what you can take. And you mentioned zinc and echinacea, and I'm a fan of those in the setting of acute infections. But remember, most of the time you're not dealing with acute infection. You're actually in a state of good health, and you want to maintain and improve that health. And there are several things that people that have been shown to help that you can take that will improve your immune system and its ability to respond to infections if they occur, but also to be calm when there is no infection. I'll give you some examples. One is vitamin D. And vitamin D, also known as the sunshine vitamin, is something that about three-quarters of the American population are deficient in. And if you're living up in the northerly climates where we have shorter days and less sunlight and cooler climates, you could be severely deficient in vitamin D. And unfortunately, vitamin D is not the vitamin that you can get by eating food. It really has to be obtained through being outside in the sunshine and letting your skin absorb the sun, and that's where the vitamin D comes from, or to take it in a supplemental form. And what we're realizing now is that people are not getting enough vitamin D, even if they're taking a multivitamin and even if they're eating fortified foods. So like milk, for example, and dairy products are fortified with D. But that's still not enough. Most of us need to take quite a bit more. In fact, we're thinking that the reference or the recommended intake should be at least 1,000 international units of vitamin D, and that's in addition to what you're getting through food and a multivitamin. So vitamin D is something that does have a beneficial effect on the immune system. It's shown to be protective and preventive in terms of cancer, in terms of osteoporosis, and now we're learning in terms of heart disease. And the reason why we believe it's so effective is that it has the ability to strengthen, at the same time, calm the immune system so that your immune system is not running through your bloodstream trying to attack you.
Very good. How about, is the vitamin D the same for men and women? I know I take vitamin D in my calcium supplement, but my husband doesn't take that.
Well, it's important, especially for men, because it's been shown to be preventive in terms of prostate cancer for men. And not only that, but heart disease in men are at slightly higher risk for heart disease. So I'm a big believer in taking adequate vitamin D. You can get it, again, from two sources, from being out in the sun. And, of course, you'll want to use still sunblock on the areas that have had a lot of sun exposure, like on your face, on your chest, on your hands. But those areas that haven't seen much sun, for example, on your legs or on your back or on your, I tell people even, you know, if they're, you know, nude sunbathing, it's fine because those areas really haven't seen any sun in your life. And that's one good way to get additional amount of vitamin D. And the supplements now of vitamin D, and the best type to take is vitamin D3, should be taken by both men and women as well as kids and adolescents. It's important to get adequate amounts of vitamin D for its preventive effect in terms of cancer, in terms of heart disease, in terms of osteoporosis. It's very important. So we know that the needs for vitamin D are much higher than the previous RDAs. So right now, 400 units that comes in a vitamin pill is not enough. You really have to increase that. I recommend people take between 1 and 5,000 units a day. Of course, you can't overdose on vitamin D when you get up around 10,000 units a day or more, but it's usually not an issue for people unless they're, you know, a golf pro and you're outdoors all the time, or a tennis pro, or you're a lifeguard and you're getting a lot of sun anyway. But if you're generally not in those high sun occupations and exposures, you should be getting between 1 and 5,000 units of vitamin D a day.
Very interesting. I hope you'll continue with your other six.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We have some other people here, and we'll talk next with someone in Saybrook, and that's line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just would like you very much to, if you could give me a quick kind of overview of kind of a little explanation of how exactly I'm a type 2 diabetic. How exactly my immune system might have caused that? And since I need to get back to driving, I pulled over to do this. I'd like to just hang up and listen to it while I go back to driving.
Sure. Well, all right.
Okay.
Yeah,
Dr.
Laponis, good. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, your situation is a very common one right now with the rise of type 2 diabetes is so common. And what we know about diabetes is that it's very strongly linked with an overactive immune system. The immune system, and people know this generically as inflammation in the system or inflammation in the blood. And what's interesting is inflammation in the blood, which is also a sign of an overactive immune system, precedes the development of diabetes. So it predicts someone who would go on to become diabetic. And we believe the mechanism has to do with a very important thing, which is the production of something called leptin. And leptin is a hormone made by fat cells. And it's especially made in fat cells that are located in the belly. And there are two basic types of fat. There's fat that's under the skin. We call that subcutaneous fat. That's the stuff that you can pinch when you try to pinch your arm or pinch your thigh. You can feel under the skin there's a layer of fat there. And there's no problem with that fat. It's not dangerous. But there's another kind of fat that's called visceral fat. And that fat is located inside the abdominal cavity. It's actually surrounding the organs inside the belly, like the liver, the pancreas, the bowel, are surrounded by this visceral fat. And that visceral fat produces a hormone called leptin. And leptin is an interesting hormone because it triggers an inflammatory reaction in the body. It's what we call pro-inflammatory. And so people who carry more of this abdominal fat will have higher levels of this hormone leptin, and that will be triggering an inflammatory reaction in the body. It's actually revving up your immune system. And we know that is a very big driver of diabetes, this abdominal fat. And one way that we advise people and we counsel them to get rid of their diabetes, and maybe you've been told this, maybe you haven't, but it's possible to cure type 2 diabetes. And the way to cure type 2 diabetes is by getting rid of that abdominal fat. And, of course, the ways to do that are, you know, through losing that weight are by doing a couple things. One, reducing your intake of calories, but especially the sugar-rich calories that come from things like sweets and desserts, but also from refined grains like the white foods, your white bread, your white pasta, your white rice, your cereals. Those foods actually contribute to abdominal fat, and those should be reduced in your diet. While at the same time, you're increasing your calorie expenditure by doing some aerobic exercise. And we advise people to be doing about 30 to 40 minutes of aerobic exercise a day, whether that's on the treadmill or on the elliptical or on the bicycle or getting in the pool. And that 30 to 40 minutes of aerobic exercise makes you break a sweat. It gets your heart rate up over 100 and ideally in your target heart range. And by doing that combination of two things, one, reducing these what we call high glycemic foods in the diet, and getting that 30 to 40 minutes of aerobic exercise a day, you'll start to lose that abdominal or visceral fat. That will lower the levels of inflammation. It lowers the C-reactive protein very, very effectively. And then you'll overcome the diabetes. And it's even possible to cure type 2 diabetes using that strategy.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let me ask you something else. This was someone called in earlier, and it was also somebody who was listening while they were driving. And I'm glad to hear people are not trying to drive and talk on the phone at the same time. This was just a couple of more questions about this testing for the C-reactive protein. Someone wanted you to see if you could talk about high results for regular C-reactive 21 and sensitive 9. And particularly to talk about what apparently those numbers that are attached to that, what do they mean?
Yeah, so when people get the blood test, the C-reactive protein blood test, they want to know how to interpret their results. And the lab will tell you that for the highly sensitive C-reactive protein test, which sometimes is called the cardio CRP test, the lab will tell you normal is from 0 to 3. And in the Jupiter study, again, remember, they treated anyone who had a CRP level of 2 or greater. And in this study, they actually looked at 17,800 people in 26 countries, and it included both men and women, it included minorities, it included some people that smoked, some people who did not. And they were planning to run the study for 5 years, but they stopped the study prematurely after only 1.9 years because they found such a dramatic improvement, such dramatic reduction in heart attack. For example, a 54% reduction in heart attacks, a 48% reduction in strokes, and a 20% reduction in deaths in the group who was on treatment to lower the C-reactive protein level. And remember, they used a cutoff of 2. But if you look at the other studies in combination, you'll learn that the target should be even lower than 2. To be in the lowest risk group for any diseases and conditions, you want the C-reactive protein level to be less than 0.7. So I'm recommending to my patients they need to keep doing something until the C-reactive protein level is down below 0.7. And, you know, medication is just one of the ways, again, to lower the C-reactive protein level. And I should make a point because it's pertinent to the question you asked, David, and that is when you get your C-reactive protein test results back, look at the units that it's measured in, because different labs will give results in different with different units. And what you want is less than 0.7 milligrams per liter. And on your results, that'll be shown as mg/L, milligrams per liter of blood. And some labs reported as milligrams per deciliter, which is mg/dl. And a deciliter is 1/10 of a liter. So to actually adjust the result, if it's reported in milligrams per deciliter, you have to multiply by 10. Mm-hmm. So if you're coming up with, let's say, 0.3 milligrams per deciliter, that's actually too high. That's 3 milligrams per liter. So look at the units and make sure it's being reported as milligrams per liter, and that's where your target is less than 0.7. If you're in milligrams per DL per deciliter, you have to multiply your result by 10 to find out your actual result in the CRP test. So that's very important and a great question. Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay, good. And that just points to, and I know it's difficult sometimes people getting their questions answered or getting time with their doctors, but certainly when you get test results back, if you're not sure what they mean, You really, and it may take some effort, but people really have to get, find someone who can explain it to them. So you can say, all right, tell me exactly what are these numbers and what do they mean, and particularly what do they mean to me? You know, what are you saying, or are you saying that I should do anything in response to what this test shows?
Well, sure. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, of course, because people have questions. They get a high level back on their CRP, and they want to know what they can do. And, of course, their doctor says, well, here, take this medication, which is, could be fine. But at the same time, there are six or seven other things that people could be doing themselves to lower their C-reactive protein level. And those, you know, the book was called Ultra Longevity, the seven-step program for a younger, healthier you. But it could have been the seven ways to lower your C-reactive protein, because that's really what the book's about.
Well, and that probably wouldn't sell quite as well as...
quite as well.
Ultra Longevity. Well, real quick, let me introduce again the guest, and then we have some other calls. We're talking with Dr. Mark Laponis. He is an internal medicine physician. He's board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine. He's the medical director of the Canyon Ranch Health Resorts, and they have a number of places. They have a place in Arizona, they're in Las Vegas, they're in Florida, and also in Lenox, Massachusetts, where he makes his home. And if you're interested in reading more on this subject, you can look for his book, Ultra Longevity. As we've mentioned, it's published, and it's now out in paperback, published by Little Brown, so I'm sure you can go to the bookstore or you can go to the library and you can take a look at it. And questions are welcome here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And the next caller that we have is Urbana and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a two-part question. One is how do we know what a normal immune system is? I assume it's measured by the number of white blood cells in the test. And the other is, what do you do if the balance between different types of white blood cells isn't exactly what you would like to have? What one can do about that?
Well, it's a great question, and you're absolutely right. In fact, one of the first measurements ever of the immune system was measuring the white blood count, very simply the number of white blood cells in a drop of blood. And the normal range is between 4,000 and 10,000 white blood cells, and that's per microliter. And a microliter is a millionth of a liter. So let's say a normal white blood count is about 6,000 white blood cells per millionth of a liter. Well, that means there's about, there's in a millionth of a liter, we've got about 6 liters of blood in our body, which means that there are roughly about 30 billion with a B, circulating white blood cells in your blood at any one time. You know, there are, you know, only 6.5 billion people on the planet, but there are 30 billion white blood cells in your bloodstream right now. And what they found is the higher your white blood count, the higher your risk of death from all causes. In fact, it's a reasonably good predictor. The higher the white blood count, the more likely you are to die. And so we like to see people who have normal but low normal white blood cell counts in the range of about 4,000 per microliter. And so that's been the very first measurement of the immune system. But now we have more sophisticated ways to measure the activity of the immune system, like the C-reactive protein test, or another one is the SED rate, the erythrocyte sedimentation rate. Very good predictor, also a good measure of the activity of the immune system. And of those 30 billion white blood cells in your bloodstream, you're absolutely right. There's a mix of different types of white blood cells, and those white blood cells have been specialized to fight different threats. So, for example, there are neutrophils that fight bacteria. There are lymphocytes that are more related to production of antibodies and in fighting viruses. There are monocytes that go up with certain conditions, like mononucleosis is a disease where the monocyte counts are up. Then we have basophils. We have eosinophils that are responsible for the allergic response. So when the proportions of white blood cells are abnormal, it usually indicates some type of infection. So, for example, if the neutrophils were high, that usually indicates a bacterial infection. If the lymphocytes were high, it might indicate a viral infection. If the eosinophils were high, it might indicate an allergy. If the monocytes were high, maybe mononucleosis. So it gives us some clues as to what stress your immune system is responding to. If none of those are the case, then it might be a problem with the bone marrow itself that's responsible for producing these white blood cells. And so those are clues that we use as doctors to try to identify what your white blood cells are responding to. Is it an infection with a bacteria or a virus or mononucleosis or a parasite or an allergy of some kind? So I hope that answers your question about the types of white blood
cells. I have one little follow-up.
Yeah. Yes.
If one of those, like neutrophils, is at the low end of normal,
yes.
Is there no other symptom or anything? Is there any way that I can do anything about it to improve that number?
Well, all I would say is you have to think this in a different frame of mind. Having a low percentage of neutrophils might be a good thing, because what that means is your body is not responding to a bacterial infection, and that actually could be a good state. So if someone had a low normal white count with slightly lower neutrophils, I wouldn't be concerned about that. In fact, I might think that that was a good goal to shoot for, because it indicates the freedom or absence from an active bacterial infection.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right.
You're welcome.
Some good feeling.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go and talk with someone else. This is someone who is calling from Davenport, Iowa. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a couple of questions. The first one, I had heard about this study that you described here. And so when I went to my doctor for a physical exam, I asked him about the CRP test, and he disregarded it for me on the basis that it wasn't very reliable and it might be more misleading than anything else.
Okay, that's one question. Did you have another?
Yes, that's one question.
Okay, so let's answer that first. You know, I'd say here I disagree with your doctor.
Uh-huh.
The CRP test not only is reliable, it's quite accurate. The assays now are very reproducible, and it would, again, be very helpful to know what your risk was. Now, one thing I will say, the time to measure your C-reactive protein level is not when you have pneumonia or you've got a kidney infection or you're recovering from a broken hip or a broken leg, because during those times it will be up because your immune system is responding to the stress of those infections or injuries.
Mm-hmm.
The time to measure your C-reactive protein level is when you go in for your annual checkup and you feel fine like you normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And along with your cholesterol and your blood sugar, for example, you want to measure the C-reactive protein to know what your baseline level is. And if it's elevated, you need to take steps to lower it, not necessarily go on medication, but to follow the 7 steps in the book so that you can start to affect the C-reactive protein level and lower it so that you don't need to take the medication.
All right, and the second part of my question, I'm 68 years old and very healthy, exercise, decent diet and everything, and for the first time my cholesterol popped up into that warning area. I think it was a total of 216.
Mm-hmm.
And what he suggested for me, which I'm taking, and we haven't been back, it hasn't been long enough to retest it again, is niacin.
Sure. Well, niacin is one of the vitamins, vitamin B3. And in
uh-huh.
sort of industrial doses, it has been shown to help improve the pattern of cholesterol. Now, cholesterol is important for the body. In fact, it's necessary for the body. We can't live without cholesterol. Every cell in the body has cholesterol in it. And if we took all the cholesterol out of your body at once, you'd fall down dead. You absolutely
uh-huh.
need cholesterol. And as you know, there's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol.
Right.
And so a 216 level wouldn't alarm me unless the level of bad cholesterol were too high and the level of good cholesterol were too low. So looking at the kind of cholesterol is just as important as that total number. And niacin has some value because it's able to raise the level of good cholesterol quite effectively. But I will say that niacin also has some potential side effects. For example, it can make your skin flush and turn red and itch quite a bit. I've had people who've had palpitations or nausea from taking a lot of niacin, and it also can raise your blood sugar level and something called homocysteine if it's taken in large doses. So you have to be careful with niacin. And generally, before I get somebody taking niacin, we're doing the other things that are so important in terms of controlling weight, getting physical exercise, making sure that we're sleeping well through the night, that we're doing taking the right vitamins, like vitamin D, for example, the things that really help to improve these numbers, again, without having to resort necessarily to taking something that could have side effects.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good. I appreciate the call. We have a number of other callers here, and we'll continue. Our next is someone here in Urbana, where we are. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Quick question. I'll hang up and listen offline.
Okay.
In a discussion the other day, it came up, we were talking about vitamin D, and someone asked a question about sunblock and whether or not sunblock stops the absorption of vitamin D. So that's my question.
It's a good question, and the answer is yes, sunblock does stop the production of vitamin D, because what it does is it blocks the UV rays from reaching your skin, and it takes those UV rays hitting your skin to have your skin actually produce the early forms of vitamin D that then go to the liver and the kidneys where the active forms of vitamin D are produced. So sunblock use will block your vitamin D production. It's why I recommend when people do go out to get their sunlight, they use block in the areas that have seen too much sun already. And that's typically the face, the chest, and the hands. The other areas, they stay out without the sunblock so that they do get their vitamin D absorption. And, of course, you have to adjust this advice based on whether you live in the tropics where the sun is very strong or you're living in Minnesota where the sun is very weak. The idea is that you should have a bit of a tan, but, of course, never a sunburn.
Okay. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, let me again introduce, is Dr. Mark Laponis. He is an internal medicine physician. He's board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine. He is a medical director of the Canyon Ranch Health Resorts, and they have a number of them, including one in Lenox, Massachusetts, where he lives. He is the author of the book Ultra Longevity, The 7-Step Program for a Younger, Healthier You. That's the subtitle. It's now available in paper, published by Little Brown, and it does make the argument, as he has discussed, that it's important that we take care of our immune systems, and what we want is not to have them revved up all the time and be overactive. What we want is for them to be calm, and so the book outlines a number of things that you can do, and things that I think that generally, if you did them, you'd be healthy. Things like have a good diet, have a diet that's nutritious, and not be overweight, and get exercise, and of course not smoke, and do positive things for you. And so, if you want to take a look at it, go to the bookstore, go to the library. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign, Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Ellsworth. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I just tuned in. You had addressed multiple sclerosis today on your show.
I don't think that we have. You have a question about it?
Yes, my husband. I'll just quickly. He had a major exacerbation at age 67, and has not had anything since in 3 years. Fairly good recovery from that one, but. Just 2 days ago, an MS specialist mentioned that he may have had a good immune system, but then maybe his immune system got out of whack when he had this overactive, when he had this exacerbation, and that he may not have any more. And he's calling it ADEM, ADEM.
Well, it's a good question, and I understand multiple sclerosis, of course, is one of the autoimmune diseases where the immune system is attacking the insulation around the nerve cells. It's called myelin. And this autoimmune attack is where our immune system is actually destroying part of our nervous system, leading to the disability that comes from multiple sclerosis. What's interesting about MS is that it's really a disease of northerly climates. It's found much, much more commonly in temperate climates as opposed to in the Sun Belt. In fact, people that live in the Sun Belt seem to be protected against getting MS, and we believe one of the mechanisms may be related to vitamin D. If you're living up in the northern latitudes, of course, as we are here in Lenox, Massachusetts, we have more MS because we don't see as much sun. The days are shorter, the sun is lower in the sky. People do not have vitamin D levels that are adequate here in the Northeast to protect them against MS. So we believe that one of the most important preventive measures for MS and for all the autoimmune diseases is to get adequate amounts of vitamin D, which you can get either through sunshine or a combination of sunshine and taking vitamin D3 supplements, which is what I recommend for my patients, to ensure that you're getting adequate amounts of vitamin D. And the best way to be sure is to get a blood test for vitamin D. And that's important because some people absorb vitamin D well, other people do not. And if you're not getting the sunshine, you want to make sure that you're absorbing the vitamin D that you're taking. And so you take a blood test, and the specific test is called 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And that's one you want to ask your doctor for. Can I have my 25-hydroxyvitamin D level checked? And your target is to be over 40. You'd like your level to be over 40. Then you know you're protected. So that's something that would be very important for your husband and for yourself and probably for your kids if you have any.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, he just has had that done, but we haven't gotten the results back. So
great.
So that's good to know.
Well,
and
give
he
you some
is
information
taking
about
1,000 milligrams of vitamin D. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. On to Sheldon, Illinois, line 4. This is our toll-free line. Hello.
I tuned in late, so I don't know what your specialty is, but I have a question about AFib.
Yes.
If my heart is working correctly, I can sleep all night without getting up and going to the bathroom.
Yes.
But when it goes into really major defib, which it does sometimes for days on end, mm-hmm. at night I may go to the bathroom almost hourly.
I see.
Is this possibly due to the heart, or is it some other thing that might be doing it?
Well, to answer your question, I'm an internist. I'm a preventive medicine doctor, but also in internal medicine. I know quite a bit about AFib, and thanks for your question. The AFib, for short, or the longer name atrial fibrillation, is an arrhythmia of the heart, where the heart rhythm loses its synchronicity, and it's able to go too fast because it's lost a communication between the natural pacemaker of the heart and the pumping chambers. And as a result, the heart rate can be wildly variable. It might be, you know, go from 90 up to 150, 180, or sometimes even higher. And you're right, when that heart rate becomes so erratic and irregular, it certainly can awaken somebody. And what's very interesting is if something like that interferes with sleep, then that, of course, will have an adverse effect on the immune system, because anything that interferes with sleep will adversely affect the immune system. In fact, they did a study on medical students where they kept them awake for 80 hours straight and drew their blood every 90 minutes for the CRP test. And they found that over 80 hours of sleeplessness, their CRP levels went up by a factor of 5. And so it's very important for us to be getting the sleep that we need and not getting up every hour like you describe. And what I would ask is it the atrial fibrillation that's waking you up, or is it some problem with sleep that's triggering the atrial fibrillation? And then that's, you know, it's a chicken or the egg situation. And, of course, one of the things that can interfere with sleep is something called sleep apnea, where people actually are having breath-holding spells through the night. And what that does is it's caused by a blockage that, where the tongue actually blocks the airway. And when that happens, your body releases adrenaline. And adrenaline, because it's a stimulant, has its effect on the heart to speed it up or make it irregular. And so I'm just wondering if there's a chicken or the egg situation where potentially there might be something like sleep apnea that might be triggering the fibrillation occurring at night. Now, if that's been looked for and it's not the case, the atrial fibrillation might just be happening for other reasons. But I think it's important to figure that out, because anything that interrupts your sleep and is waking you up hourly needs to be corrected, because without that good quality sleep, you will have an elevated C-reactive protein level that could, again, adversely affect your long-term health.
Thank you. As soon as my head hits the pillow, I fall asleep.
Good.
I was only aware of the fact that I got up that often after I was asked to check.
Do you snore?
No.
That's often a sign of people that have sleep apnea, is they're known to snore, because as that tongue blocks the airway, it causes the snoring before the airway is fully blocked. So that's just something to keep in mind. It'd be worth asking your doctor about again. And I think you need to work with your cardiologist and your doctor about ways to control that atrial fibrillation. It's very important.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we'll go to line number one next. Someone on cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just had a question. I had heard you mentioned homocysteine levels in a question ways back, and I wondered if you could discuss that a little bit, homocysteine levels as related to immunity and possibly C-reactive protein, and I'm going to hang up and listen.
Thanks for your question. Yeah, homocysteine is a chemical in the blood that's been linked with more cardiovascular disease. It's been linked with more heart attack, more stroke. High levels of homocysteine, generally over 12, have been linked with higher risk, and there've been many studies on homocysteine that clearly identify this risk between this chemical in the blood, homocysteine, and cardiovascular disease. The problem is that in trying to lower homocysteine levels by taking added amounts of B vitamins, specifically folic acid, B6, and B12, we didn't find that protected people against heart disease. It seems like it's important to lower the homocysteine not by taking extra vitamins, but by actually changing your diet and lifestyle in a way that helps to lower homocysteine levels. To finish your question, the relationship between homocysteine and C-reactive protein is that they're independent. In other words, you can have a high homocysteine level and a normal C-reactive protein, or a high C-reactive protein and a lower and a high homocysteine level. They're independent and unrelated. The dietary factors that raise homocysteine are a lack of green leafy vegetables, too much coffee, and too much red meat, as well as too much alcohol. So if somebody had a high homocysteine level, I would try to have them reduce their red meat intake, reduce their saturated, their animal fat intake, reduce their coffee intake, and reduce alcohol. Those are the ways to help improve homocysteine levels.
Right, again, hope that helps. We have time for at least one more, maybe two callers in the time that's left. We'll go next to someone here where we are in Champaign, line number three. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
What about in terms of arthritis, anything connected there? And also, and this is going maybe far afield, higher levels of intraocular pressure, in the eye. So any comments there?
Yeah, on two questions, arthritis and intraocular pressure or glaucoma. In terms of arthritis, this is another form of an autoimmune disease. It's where your immune system is in the joints, gobbling up the cartilage and attacking the joint lining. And it's an important thing to treat, because when there's that inflammation in the joints, that extends over into the bloodstream and can trigger other conditions like heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, etc. Some of the things that I use for arthritis treatment, fish oil. I recommend taking an EPA DHA supplement, about 3 grams a day. I also usually give chondroitin sulfate in a dose of about 400 milligrams 3 times a day. We believe that things like, again, vitamin D is very important in the prevention of arthritis. So those are things that I do to try to control the inflammation that's occurring with arthritis. And in terms of increased intraocular pressure or glaucoma, it's a good question. Sometimes it's related to a high blood pressure. If someone has high blood pressure, it can contribute to higher pressure in the eye. We've also found that, surprisingly, one of the things that can contribute to glaucoma is wearing a tie in men. Just having that necktie around your neck raises the pressure in the eyes, because the effect that it has on congesting the veins in the neck. And so if you're going to work and wearing a tie, I'd say loosen it up a little bit, or find out if that's necessary, because that's one of the ways to help lower intraocular pressure, is to loosen the necktie up a little bit. I hope that's helpful.
Okay.
All right.
Very articulate.
Another good reason not to wear a tie.
I don't need a good reason.
Let's see. We'll go at least. We'll try to get one more. This is line two, and it's Champagne. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yeah.
Real quickly, I would like your opinion about this. These are my stats. I have a 240 cholesterol. I have an HDL now. I mean, an LDL that is higher than it should be. It's 138. My HDL is 89. I have low blood pressure, and I am in the process of getting a booking for the CRP test. But I have refused to go on statins because I think my HDL is so good that my risk is low. Do you concur with that?
Well, you know what's interesting about that, and it's a great question because it's a common thing that comes up. There's some other things we can probably tell about you, and I never met you. I don't know who's calling, but I can tell you a few things. One, you've got a narrow waist and bigger hips. Very common, of course, for this pattern. The people that are opposite and they've got a wider waist and narrow hips have the opposite pattern. They have the low HDL. They have a lower cholesterol. Their LDL tends to be higher, and they have higher triglycerides. So in your case, you probably have a nice hourglass shape. You run a low blood pressure. You have a high HDL. And there's nothing about your results that would make me prescribe a statin.
You're right on the money about the body.
This is such a common thing for people that, you know, when you have wider hips, an hourglass shape, you're protected against cardiovascular disease, so you're less likely to need a statin. I'd also predict your CRP test will be fairly good. And that will be the decision point. If your CRP is less than 2, I wouldn't recommend a statin for you. And if you're less than 0.7, I wouldn't even consider a statin.
Oh, that's exactly why I wanted to take the test. I just heard about all this, and I thought this is another tool for me to know whether I am correct.
I think you're very wise to do so.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we're going to have to stop. We're just come to the end of the time. I certainly would suggest if you'd like to read more about this, you can take a look at the book that our guest, Dr. Mark Laponis, has written, Ultra Longevity. It's published by Little Brown, is now out in paperback, so you could buy it in the bookstore. You could look at it in the library. He is the medical director of the Canyon Ranch Spa in all its locations, including one where he lives in Massachusetts. And Dr. Laponis, we just want to say to you, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me on the show, David. Thank you.